This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We still have a chance to save ourselves.
Before I introduce our next guest, let's try this. Yesterday, during a phone check, you talked to me about an Isaac Asimov science fiction novel and the possibility of a psychology of the future. What was that about?
Yeah, I was, of course, like so many of us, raised on science fiction. I loved it. And I think you'll find that most scientists today still secretly or unsecretly still love science fiction. But the great Isaac Asimov wrote several books called the Foundation series. And the crux and the center of this was that psychologists were in the future able to produce a quantitative way of understanding and predicting human behavior. And in so doing, they tried to produce a new empire that would forestall 10,000 years of chaos, or so the story went. And this was called psychohistory. I'm wondering if we are not through a totally different way approaching that, because I think what I'm hoping is that psychologists begin merging with biologists to understand the effect of stress molecules through time as a predictive aspect.
Listeners, did you guess our guest? Longtime Radio EcoShock listeners will remember several previous interviews with University of Washington Professor Peter Ward. We talked about the causes of past mass extinctions, about climate change in the deep past and the near future, about sea level rise, and even his theory that life may have suicidal tendencies. But now Peter is back with something completely different, as you've heard, and it is epigenetics, and it could change everything. Peter Ward, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
And thank you for having me.
Well, look, you know, we are all busy people. We are probably bombarded with more information every day than our village ancestors received in a lifetime. Why should we make room in our brains for epigenetics?
Well, it's interesting. Science progresses in a very conservative fashion, as we know. And there were historians of science and philosophers of science who suggested that the way science proceeds, again, is very conservative, very conservative. And it's only through revolutionary change, called a paradigm change, that we see an entirely new type of understanding. For instance, Copernicus putting the Earth around the sun rather than vice versa. Einstein with relativity. Quantum mechanics, there are any number of these. Plate tectonics, close to home. The idea that continents could move was heresy until the 1960s. Well, we're seeing something now that's very interesting. It's potentially, perhaps not on the order of those others, but potentially even more important. This is the understanding that the great long-dead biologist Jean Lamarck and his French colleagues in the 1780s, Lamarck has produced or did produce an idea about evolution called Lamarckism. It is and has been ridiculed ever since Darwin. Well, now scientists are understanding that some of the things that Lamarck proposed may actually be taking place. And the single most important is that things that happen to you in your life may actually change your genes in such a way that it affects the children that you will have.
So does it actually change the genes, or does it change the expression of those genes? I mean, genes offer you a selection of several different choices, and if you choose this, you get door number A, and if you choose that, you get door number B. Is that the way it's working?
Yeah, you're exactly correct. The genes themselves, the actual gene sequence that you pass on, that stays the same. And so this was what Darwin suggested, even before he knew about genes. And it's always been a comfort, I think, to think that no matter how much you screw up your life, you are not going to change the family, the sum total of the genes that you pass on. But when I say change the genes, I mean that there are effects during our lives, great environmental changes, that add on tiny little freeloaders. The most common method for epigenetics is that a gene becomes methylated, a tiny little organic molecule, a carbon with a couple of hydrogens, is added on to the DNA molecule. It goes on like a little limpet or a little parasite. And it used to be thought that when we passed on sperm and eggs, that all of these markers, all these tiny freeloaders, were erased, and that none of the information, such information, was passed on. The new discoveries is that this is not true. And the most interesting and the scariest deal with the effects that huge amounts of environmental change can have on us, and not just on us, all animals, all plants, all microbes, and that these, in effect, the most dangerous for humans being violence and huge stressful situations can affect our children for at least three generations.
Well, I heard you were bringing out a new book called Lamarck's Revenge, How Epigenetics is Revolutionizing Our Understanding of Evolution's Past and Present. And I thought, what is Peter Ward doing in epigenetics? That's not really your field. How did you get going in that? And then I started thinking about our very first Radio EcoShock interview where you talked about exploring rocks off the coast of British Columbia, and you saw with your own eyes a layer that represented 10 million years with no sign of life, and then there's life again. And I'm wondering if that unexplainable shift is what tossed you into this new field to reconsider evolution.
Well, absolutely. I mean, a paleontologist is doing nothing but studying the change of animals through time in the fossil record. But what really has always been the greatest knock against current paleontology, and especially the evolutionary theory behind it, is that some species seem to occur, they change so quickly that it seems impossible that this could have happened anyway other than through some divine effect, that we're talking about intelligent design with some godlike being who orchestrates and produces, through magic, I guess, a new species. And there continues to be the anti-evolution push by those called creationists, and there's all kinds of creationists, and it seemed to be that it must be a better way. And what epigenetics is showing us is that there can be evolutionary change up to 1,000 times faster than can take place through normal Darwinian mechanisms. We remember the way that Darwin and all evolutionists subsequent to him have suggested is that evolution takes place through random, slow genetic mutations. Most of those mutations are really bad, deleterious. A few are good, and natural selection then favors those with these improved, if you will, I hate to use that word, but improved set of genes. In epigenetics, we have a way of producing much more variability much more quickly, way faster, and it removes the stigma of saying, oh my gosh, that species occurred way too quickly for natural processes. No, it didn't.
Well, that raises a crazy hope in me, Peter, because I feel like our present human brains are just not up to the job of climate change, that we are creating in all of our technologies things that we don't even know where they're going, whether it's artificial intelligence and all that. So there have been people who said, well, we just need to evolve into a new species. We'll awaken into something else. But, of course, that would take much longer than we have. But maybe with epigenetics, we could actually change some way so we can survive who we are.
Well, you're exactly right. And really, the most important epigenetic process that is now used by humans is the manipulation of genes through something called a CRISPR Cas9 type of process. CRISPR-Cas9 is a set of proteins. You can inject it, and what it is, it's really a hunt and search program that hones in on one particular gene in a genome. You can go and destroy a particular gene, and then you can replace it with one that you want. Now, we know that this is taking place. It is like magic, but it's not. Chinese scientists used a CRISPR method to insert a different type of gene in dogs. This gene called for gigantic muscles. So they took the skinniest known dogs, whippets, put one gene change in, and they produce these enormously muscular dogs. They did it with beagles. They on purpose took these really sort of funny, happy-looking dogs and produced enormous military-grade dogs. And their statement was that these dogs could be useful as military weapons.
Watch out for attack whippets.
Well, I mean, this is the funny deal, but let's put this inside a mastiff or a German Shepherd. And it isn't just the muscles. Let's put a gene in for longer teeth. Let's put a gene in that lets the dog live and work with much less need for food, much less need for water. It doesn't get as tired. We increase its size. CRISPR-Cas9 has all of these potentials. And, of course, the next step is, if you can do it in a dog, can you do it in a human? And the answer is yes.
Well, but couldn't we do something similar to help with the epidemic of obesity and diabetes and maybe even cancer? I mean, get some of the diseases looked after rather than military weapons.
Well, yes, and what you hope to see is that we remove some of the most horrendous of genetic diseases, these inherited maladies that are themselves quite often produced by one bad gene. The hope of CRISPR is that you can remove that gene. So the reason I bring this up is that CRISPR is a change in gene during the lifetime of an animal. That's a Lamarckian process. That's not Darwinian. That's Lamarck. That's epigenetics. And epigenetics at its most powerful as well as its most scary.
Well, let's go back a little bit in time. You look in your book at the example of the Black Plague in the 1300s, and who doesn't think about the Black Death? Well, I know that the French intellectual Michel Foucault saw the plague as the start of a prison society, but you call it an epigenetic event. Would you like to talk about that? How did it affect all following generations?
Well, we know, interestingly enough, that organisms that are pushed into highly stressful situations, such as starvation, such as disease, such as warfare, violence, produce an excess of stress molecules. We humans have a molecule called cortisol. It is the same molecule that was first evolved way back 500 billion years ago by the most primeval fish and modern-day lampreys, these awful sucking creatures, have it just as we have it. So we have a 500 million year old molecule, not improved in 500 million years, that is like a blunt hammer. The thing about this molecule is when we're stressed, eventually stress dissipates. And it does so because there are tiny little bits, tiny molecules within cells that are like tiny little enzyme destroyers. They chew up the stress molecule, knock off some atoms, and the stress molecule no longer produces the stress. But in some people, these changes reduce the number of stress reducers. And we have a gene called the MAO gene, sometimes called the violence gene, that in some people, if it is produced through violence, that the gene is there, but the gene is pushed into this extreme form by violent events, that can be passed on. And these people have stress molecules that never go away. After a while, when you have such long-term stress, you no longer react to it at all. And there has been correlation between this particular gene and homicides, violent crimes, a great deal of madness going on in Scandinavia. I mean, it's a very difficult subject to test now. If you go out and test your children and find they have this bad sort of gene, what are you going to do? And so we're really seeing this whole new world. I go back to your first statement, could we make things better? Well, we know that human intelligence is not coded on any one gene. It's coded on hundreds and hundreds. I think the last I heard was 400. It's probably more than that. So one single gene change isn't going to do much for human intelligence. But who says you have to stop at one? These things, it has now been successfully shown that you can use the CRISPR-Cas9 method on a human embryo. And that embryo takes this new gene and then goes forward through time. And not only does the embryo and the subsequent human, they never let it get beyond a few days in age, but they could have, not only does the embryo keep it, but it passes on this new gene to all subsequent generations. Let's go back to the Black Death. We know that in times of high stress, a second aspect of stress does, it increases mutation rates. Mutation rates themselves, a Darwinian mechanism, if you can increase the rate of mutations, you push more rapidly evolution. During the Black Death, what could be more horrible than watching your loved ones die? We always think about the battlefield soldiers. We think about the people killed by the Black Death. When they're killed, however, their genes are not passed forward. Any future children, that's over with. But the survivors, we never think about the survivors. What stress it must have been to watch 4/5 of all of your children die. And how that would, I think, really stimulate evolutionary change in the survivors moving forward.
Well, I want to get back to that subject of how near-death experiences could affect our children and their children maybe even. But I'm also thinking, Peter, about what we talked about in the very beginning of this, how the future could affect the present. And I say that because lately I've seen more and more emails from people who are saying they're deeply worried about climate science and what emissions really mean for our future. They may not even want to have children. I'm wondering if there could exist a kind of pre-climatic stress syndrome, kind of like PTSD, but ahead of the event. Is it possible that even presumptions about the future could also have an epigenetic effect through the stress mechanism that you're describing?
Absolutely. I got myself in enormous trouble 2 years ago. Gizmodo, which is a website somewhere in the U.S., I guess, called a number of we evolutionists, and I was just a random name they came up with. They know I study evolution. And they asked me about the brand new dogs that the Chinese had done. And then they asked me, could super soldiers be produced? And I said, yes, absolutely. But then I went on to say that I believe that at least in the last 5 years, we in America, I don't know about you Canadians, but it's the globe is the globe. We Americans are exhibiting every bit of evidence of highly increased stress rates. For instance, if we could take a blood sample of every single American right now, today, and every single Canadian, what would the average stress level be by age, by gender, by sexual orientation, by race? Do we see a change then with how those stress levels were 5 years ago? And I think, yes. And what I said in that interview that got me in so much trouble that, in fact, my university president was contacted, the Board of Regents, demanding that I be fired. I said that since the election of Trump, the stress levels in the U.S. have gone up markedly, and that this itself may have a future revolutionary effect on Americans. Boy, they didn't like that at all. I went on later after I was just eviscerated online saying, well, look, if Hillary Clinton had been elected, there would be the same amount of stress. There's just something going on in our society that is ratcheting up stress. And in so doing, we are pushing forward human evolution.
Well, I can't argue with that. And in fact, I'm surprised that you didn't get threats of violence because there's so much violence going on. I think in particular in American society right now, there was another mass shooting today and there'll probably be another one tomorrow. So that's a pretty serious situation. Look, Otter, I want to cover some of the current epigenetic events, so to speak, that you talk about in your book. And here's one of them, and it's about toxins in the environment. I'm currently corresponding with a professor in New England who studies the re-release of lethal, long-lived chemicals like PCBs, and they're reappearing as European glaciers melt in a warming world, and hurricanes like Florence can stir up environmental toxins. Talk to us about the role of that in epigenetics.
Yeah, this is a major interest to a number of people, and believe me, there are political consequences for faculty who even bring this up. Here in Washington State, there is a man that I co-dedicated the book to by the name of Skinner. He has been looking at the effect of agricultural chemicals on rats. If you want to study epigenetics, you want something that breeds quickly, and you're certainly not going to use humans, although I think we are already doing a gigantic human experiment. We'll get to that in a second. But he exposed rats to, I think the name of the chemical was vincozoline. This is something we use in fields that it doesn't kill weeds, but it ruins rust. It takes care of some of the really nasty growths on leaves that reduces overall crop yield. This stuff really affected rats. It produced second, third, and fourth generation rats that were not exposed to it. So you expose a mama or papa rat, they then have little ratlings, little pups, and those pups have had their genes methylated to the point that they exhibit really aberrant behavior. They showed a great deal of it looked like a loss of mental acuity. I mean, it sounds sort of funny, but you can actually track rats' mental acuity through mazes. But they also showed that the rats showed a vastly reduced reproductive potential. The sperm that they produced in the young males were deformed, that there were any number of birth defects, and that these were directly related to their parents being exposed. This is epigenetics. An environmental change, the parents produce their offspring. The offspring have been affected by something that they never experienced.
Radio EcoShock.
From the University of Washington, our guest is Dr. Peter Ward. We're talking about his new book, Lamarck's Revenge, How Epigenetics is Revolutionizing Our Understanding. This is Radio EcoShock, and I am Alex Smith. In 2006, Peter, I interviewed a Dr. Frederica Pereira from Columbia University, and she monitored what pregnant women in Harlem were breathing. They actually put on backpacks whenever they went out, and they had all sorts of measuring. And then they found, and this is very disturbing, that this micropollution was visibly changing parts of the DNA in their babies right in the womb, a kind of genetic expression. Now, that sounds to me like an example of epigenetics at work.
Well, it is. And in fact, the textbooks and all the research on epigenetics say that the most consequential time for any mammal is in the womb. That is the time that the embryo growing into a fetus is itself very susceptible to all kinds of epigenetic change that are brought into its environment through the mother. And so we've always known, gee, mothers shouldn't drink alcohol and on and on and on, but we have not understood the degree to which the environment the mother experiences has an effect. It's not just the physical environment, it's the mental environment. The degree of stress that a mother is going through itself can produce vast epigenetic changes in the fetus. And secondly, we always seem to give men a pass on this, saying, oh my gosh, yes, that mother, before she had children, she had all these effects in her life. She experienced violence. She experienced chemicals. But thank good, this never affects men. It's not true at all. Male sperm themselves will be burdened by these little epigenetic freeloaders when men experience nasty aspects. And some of the scariest of studies to me are dealing with men with violence against women. We always say that the children of the survivors of violence are themselves can be more violent simply because they witnessed the violence. But it really looks as if there is epigenetic effects in some of these, not all, but some of these, that produces a much higher chance that they will themselves be violent as well.
Wow. You also have a chapter on famine, and in my feeling, there was a little bit more famine in the 1960s than now. We've improved our distribution of food a bit, but right now in Yemen, there's up to 10 million people right on the edge of famine or experiencing it now, and there are various places in Africa, other places where people are pretty hungry. And we've been told poor nutrition can affect intelligence. What did you find about famine from the perspective of epigenetics?
Yes, well, the famine aspect is really one of the very first ways that the importance of epigenetics was discovered. And it goes back to World War II. A well-known aspect of the end of the war was that the Nazis tried to starve as many people in Holland as possible. And it was called the Dutch starvation, the Dutch winter starvation. This was from 1944 winter into 1945. The children coming from people who survived that famine were found often to have eating disorders. Many of them became very obese, but others, like Audrey Hepburn, they were not even, the women didn't even have to be pregnant during the famine. But if they experienced famine, they produced epigenetic changes that were passed on, leading to eating disorder and also mental disorders. The great famines of the 60s you talk about, the greatest single famine, we talked about Biafra, and we talked about Eastern Africa and Ethiopia, but it was China which experienced perhaps the most pervasive and populous famine. And this was, again, in the 60s, where Mao was trying to bring in new types of agriculture, but he was also moving as many peasants, agricultural peasants, into factories as he could. Food production lagged, and there were enormous famines. Now we are two generations after that. And still, coming from that particular event, there are epigenetic and very sad human changes that have occurred.
I'm wondering, Peter, if we can understand epigenetics better using the analogy of genetic damage from radiation. Doctors have warned that a dose of radiation can go beyond cancer in the person receiving it to changes in birth for several succeeding generations after that. Aren't there similarities?
Yes, if the change is inherited, it's epigenetics by definition. So if you are blasting the DNA of some person and they have passed on some of these changes that are heritable. Now, quite often, radiation can affect various aspects of DNA, and this might produce in that fetus changes which themselves are deleterious and that produce some really nasty effects. But these wouldn't be passed on. So you really have to distinguish between those effects which can produce these epigenetics versus those effects which simply destroy a genome, perhaps really change the coding in one gene that's necessary. But that can't be passed on.
Now, reading your article published in the journal Nautilus in August 2018, and I'll put links to that in my blog, listeners, your conclusions about epigenetic changes sound almost like a form of heritable post-traumatic stress disorder. For example, a near-death experience might change things in our bodies as well as in our minds that could even affect our children. And that's a pretty frightening possibility. Would you talk to us about that?
Well, sure. And again, the sad aspect is last night in America, we had another shooter. We had a soldier that definitely, well, I don't know, I can't say this, but this is a soldier who served multiple tours in combat zones, as I understand, and that he just, I guess what we say, he went crazy and shot up and killed many innocent people. There can be nothing, I think, more traumatic and more prone to produce epigenetic change than surviving combat. Being in combat and seeing the effects of modern weaponry has to be one of the most horrific things in the world. What happens in a scary sense is when soldiers come back, so many of them are damaged. But what we've never understood is that they're not only damaged, but they may be having permanent changes. They have these epigenetic changes that can then be passed on. One of the striking things that I did and try to put in the book, and I'm getting eviscerated for this on Amazon, but I've never gotten such poor ratings in my life, but I think I'm hitting really close to home. If you look at World War One and start with the FBI crime statistics, well, the FBI was barely in, I don't even think it was present in 1918, but indeed, there were statistics about murder rates and violence in America moving on to the time the FBI was formed. You can see that the murder rate, the violence rate, goes in a series of peaks and valleys. And these are about one generation in length. There's about a 20 to 25 to 28 year cycle of these high peaks. So World War One gives rise in one generation to World War Two, which gives rise in one generation to Vietnam. And then we move into the conflicts in Saddam country. And now, according at least to the figures that I produce, and again, I just got these off FBI websites, that we're moving up to peak violence, that the last two or three years, every single year, has seen more of these shooting events. And according to my figures, this will peak out in 2020 and then descend.
Wow. Okay. So let's picture more extreme events driven by climate change, you know, the fires, the floods, the heat, and the stress that that produces. I guess it would take a science fiction writer to try and think about what changes that may produce in the next generation, in the kids of the people who go through those climate-induced stresses.
Oh, it's going to be enormous. We already see that what climate events do, first of all, if you survive, for instance, a major hurricane, but then it's afterwards where quite often, especially if you're in what we used to call third world countries where food supply is cut off, electricity is cut off, that you are dealing with actual day-to-day survival. Stress levels from that surely must activate some of these epigenetic events. Starvation from climate change. Heat, I mean, the absolute heat stress that is being produced, heat already, we know, has huge effects on organisms. So we're looking, climate change itself is going to be a major driver of human evolution, I believe, over the next years. And let's go back to one that really, I think, hasn't gotten enough press. Male sperm levels over the last 40 years have dropped by about 50%. We're looking at least in Americans, and North America, no, it's just all North Americans, Canadians too, sperm counts are way, way down. They are not down in Africa nor in South America. So the authors of this, and it was a long, long study with thousands of data, so this is not due to experimental error in any sense. They said it's either based on climate change or it's the chemicals, that we are wallowing in chemicals in North America. I suspect it's the latter. This is also tied up to the fact that the number of insects that we find in North America has dropped markedly. I mean, I used to drive across the country or anywhere in summer, and your windshield is totally splattered. But now multiple studies on multiple continents have said that the biomass of insects is less than half or even less than that in many places. We are losing insects. It could be the climate change, but I think it's a combination of climate change and the chemicals in the environment.
Yeah, I remember covering on this show a study of nature areas in Germany where people have been out counting insects meticulously for several decades, and there's no question that the life that they found there had crashed. And it's not something we all notice in our day-to-day life, especially if we live in a city, but it sure is important to the continuing existence of Earth and life on Earth anyway.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Radio EcoShock.
From the University of Washington, we are talking with Peter Ward. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. And Peter's new book is Lamarck's Revenge, How Epigenetics is Revolutionizing Our Understanding of Evolution's Past and Present. Well, ever since Jean-Baptiste Lamarck first proposed inheritance of acquired characteristics in the 1700s, that vision, Peter, as you said, has been systematically squashed by scientists who champion Charles Darwin's theory of evolution. And I know that's continuing. You've talked about some of the criticism of your book. Why do you think people react so strongly to a suggestion that there's something other than Darwin?
You know, that's a really great question. And it is, the evolutionists really don't like this. There are many who say that we're not challenging Darwinism at all. We're adding on the great paradigm of evolutionary change, biological evolution. This is simply more information about it. I mean, it's equivalent to the discovery of genetics, the discovery of what DNA is, the discovery that there are large areas of genomes that we used to think had no purpose at all, and now we're finding, in fact, they do. So we're simply adding in new information. But I think we began this conversation with my statement that science and scientists are really conservative. I mean, really conservative. The fact that any major paradigm change, there are people who study epigenetics who say, oh, no, no, we're going to totally topple evolutionary theory and a whole new theory will be built. It's not that extreme. This is adding on just a new layer of understanding. I mean, the processes that Darwin talked about do take place. Natural selection does take place. But we now know that there can be rapid changes when the environment is critical. If you really want to look at how fast this can take place and a really down-home suggestion, turns out that the fastest evolving creatures we know with vertebrates are chickens, followed by dogs. We think of it just selective breeding, but there's surely epigenetics taking place too. Lamarck said that what happens is first the environment changes, but here's then in part two, he differs from Darwin. Then he says there are behavioral change in response to the environmental change. New behavior causes organisms to act in different ways. Natural selection can begin working in entirely different ways. And at that point, you start seeing different types of morphologies that are favored that may not have been favored in the past, and you get this big flush of all kinds of different types of morphology. After the mass extinctions, we saw mammals occur in huge numbers. But those huge numbers of mammals didn't take place while the dinosaurs were there. And it's certainly the disappearance of dinosaurs opened up new ability for mammals. But the rate at which they appeared has always been the mystery. They could have and should have and would have been produced through epigenetics. Let's go back to chickens. Chickens came from a tiny little ground bird in Borneo, I believe. Looks just like a chicken, except it's tiny, about robin size. And it is, of course, a nice little meal for all the predators. So this tiny little bird spends most of its life, A, looking for food, B, trying not to get eaten. Well, what happens when you domesticate a chicken or any animal? You put it in a cage so the predators can't get it. It no longer has the worry of being eaten. Secondly, we feed domestic animals. It no longer has to spend most of its time looking for food, and C, we give it mates. It no longer has to go through the time-consuming aspects of mating. So these three things, all good things for the chicken, are also certainly major environmental change. Environmental change doesn't have to be disaster. It can also be good things. It's still a major environmental change. And from that, out of that, came this explosion of kinds based on the chicken body plan. But we know that their intelligence is different, their behaviors are different, their size is different, lots of different colors, lots of different kinds. This is for chickens, it's for dogs, it's for domestic cats. And I just wonder, too, if we humans haven't gone through our own domestication process.
I'll bet we have. I just read about a Swedish study where they took chickens and basically they didn't torture them, but they made them under stress. They kept changing the lighting and changing their food regimen and such. And then they ran them through a maze and they found that they were unable to do the maze as well as other chickens. And then they checked that their chicks that were raised separately from them, they didn't learn from their parents. And those chicks also had difficulty with the maze compared to chicks that had not had stressed out parents. So, yeah, even chickens are examples of epigenetics.
That's a classical case. Yep.
I'd like to talk about something a little bit different just for a minute, and then we'll get back to your book. And that is your first book, or your earlier book, let's say, the 2007 Under a Green Sky. You suggested a past mass extinction could have been caused by a switch from oxygen-breathing sea life to sulfate-eating bacteria instead. And I've just talked with Professor Uli Wortmann from the University of Toronto about a study published in August of 2018 that said, yeah, this is happening in the ocean, that we're seeing more sulfate-eating bacteria and the deoxygenation of the ocean is starting to happen. Do you still think that ocean warming could trigger an existential risk somewhere down the line?
Oh, absolutely. And the other, look, every bit of information we have about the temperature rise going on the planet shows that every one of these IPCC estimates have been too conservative. Once again, the same old story, scientists are conservative. And so they put out these estimates, and then lo and behold, a decade goes by, and we see that the numbers don't support it at all. We're getting warmer way faster than has been predicted in some of the worst-case scenarios. So we're seeing now that as you get warmer, this is affecting ocean bottoms. The one that scared me the most was off the west coast of California, where very large oceanic anoxic zones, these are areas on the bottom where there's no oxygen at all. These have been increasing in size and appearing in the California borderlands. This isn't just shallow water, and we see this all the time in the Gulf of Mexico, but these are deep water basins. And this is for the first time now we're seeing exactly the mechanism that brought about eventually most of the mass extinctions. We are moving along that pathway. How far do we go? Don't know. I mean, if we stop the rate of global warming right now, the oceans are still going to rise by 3 feet. But how much of the ice caps also gets melted? You know, what is the latent heat that we have already increased? How far do the ice caps melt? That's really the determining question for so much of human future history.
And in your later book, The Medea Hypothesis, you oppose James Lovelock's idea of life organizing to support life that's been dubbed Gaia. In fact, your overview of what we know of life's crazy ride on this planet, based on your paleontological studies, suggests a tendency towards mass suicide Have you changed your mind or found any reason to be more cheerful about our future?
I think just taking the conversation we've just had, I think that answers that. No, we are looking at a very harsh future. I still have hope. I think we have enormous tools. The degree to which we are producing AI, artificial intelligence, as tools is certainly going to help in many respects. Most people also say you have to be pretty careful of AI. But one of the aspects that really shocked me the most in my earlier days when I suggested the rare earth hypothesis that intelligent life in the universe might be very rare, I debated over and over with people from SETI and Seth Shostak. They're tremendously literate and public speaking frontman. Told me once that he expects that they will find aliens, but any aliens we find are not going to be biological. They will already be the changeover from biology to artificial, that we'll be looking at robots or looking at AI of some sort, that the eventual change from species such as us is a move upward. I've been reading a series of new science fiction books by actually a Canadian writer where that is discussed as part of the plot mechanism. But it is a case where we do have to look at what is the future in terms of our technology, and at what point can we get to the point where we can at least stop this rapid rise, because hot worlds are not anything we evolved in. We evolved in ice and snow. Now we're going to be seeing a planet where, at least if we continue on the rate we're going, that there's going to be no ice and no snow anywhere on this planet.
Getting back to your new book on epigenetics, with that Darwinian mindset, we all assume that our actions might affect our children psychologically if they see us drinking or if they see us fighting, as you said, but not really change them physically. But now, if epigenetics is true, then our personal responsibility changes in a super way. I mean, we really are going to have an effect on our kids and maybe even on their kids.
Yes, absolutely. And this is one of the implications that I try to write about in the book, is that one of the possibilities of this is a possibility of a new Puritan age. Let's say you have a set of grandparents, or they want to be grandparents. And it's always been focused on the mother, of course, that it's the mother who, if she drinks during pregnancy or smokes. But now we know that some of the really nasty changes can take place by our behaviors when women are not pregnant, and in men as well. We're seeing the use of drugs in Southeast Asia, the use of a drug called betel nut, which is chewed by probably, I don't know, a billion people. The parents chew this, it affects them epigenetically, and it produces a great deal of mental problems, especially attention deficit in children. This is now known. What is marijuana doing to us? I know Canada just got this forward. What does smoking do to us?
Only good things, Peter. Only good things.
Well, you're right in that we do have to understand that our entire lifetime behavior is going to affect, if we have children, it's going to affect them.
Yeah.
And the two studies that spooked me is that they took rats again, and they removed the baby rats from the mother. They allowed no contact with the mother. They fed them artificially. And for the next two generations, those rats, which had no contact, physical contact with their mother, showed a great deal of aberrant and violent behavior. Secondly, one of the classic studies in epigenetics is they took a rat, they put a nice smell, what we think it was cherry blossoms. So they had perfume that smelled like cherry blossoms. They let the rat smell the cherry blossoms, and then they shocked the holy hell out of it with electricity. Nice. So every time that rat smelled cherry blossoms, it scared it. Its generations, the next two generations, having never encountered this, when they were given the cherry blossom smell, they were scared out of their minds. Epigenetics.
But one of your critics did raise a point that these epigenetic changes may not be stable. I mean, what if they are short-lived, just lasting one or two generations, and then everything reverts back?
Well, that's true. And one or two generations, and they do revert back. But that's saying that the effects that are producing them in the one or two generations has stopped. are we going to stop climate change? Are we going to stop famine in the next generation or two? So at least in terms of humans, I don't want to sound too pessimistic, but I think the big changes affecting this evolutionarily, they're not going to go away within one or two generations. And so you do it over and over.
One final question. Is the average reader without any scientific training going to be able to read your new book?
Yeah, I've just stayed away from the really – I actually read many books on epigenetics, and I've got a PhD. I studied in a biology department. I couldn't understand half of them. So what I try to do is make this as much about fossils and the fossil record and then human history. The chapter about what epigenetics is short. If people want the real molecular and the equations, I refer them, because actually I did, the hardest part of this book was every time there's a statement, I put a footnote there. And so the notes sections are 50 pages long. I don't know, it's huge. But I want to make sure that when I make a statement that it can be backed up. And a lot of those are the technical literature. What I've tried to do is make a cogent, understandable exhibition. It's not a long book. It's only 70,000 words, but at least it's a statement about how this could affect evolution, but mostly it's a statement about how it can affect us.
We have been speaking with Professor Peter Ward from the University of Washington. His latest book is Lamarck's Revenge, How Epigenetics is Revolutionizing Our Understanding of Evolution's Past and Present. I will put links to Peter, his book, and this conversation in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org, so look for that. It's published every Wednesday online. And Peter, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, no matter how gloomy the subject.
But it's not. I mean, the other good news is, once again, epigenetics holds promise to make life better for many of us. And for many of our animals, for better food, there's the possibility we can increase food. We can affect the changes that climate change is going to do to us. So I tend to be on the sunny side, that I think the benefits can be better than the downsides.
Peter Ward on the sunny side. I'm not sure I'm ready. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. In our interview, Peter Ward talks about the Dutch hunger winter. It was the first well-documented case of epigenetics. I'm going to read you a few lightly edited paragraphs from the Wikipedia entry on the heritable health impacts of the Dutch famine of 1944-45. Quote, the Dutch famine of 1944-45 was a rare case of a famine which took place in a modern, developed, and literate country, albeit one suffering under the privations of occupation and war. The well-documented experience has helped scientists to measure the effects of famine on human health. The Dutch famine birth cohort studied, carried out by health scientists in Amsterdam and Britain, found that the children of pregnant women exposed to famine were more susceptible to diabetes, obesity, cardiovascular disease, and other health problems. The discovery of the cause of celiac disease may also be partly attributed to the Dutch famine. With wheat in very short supply, there was an improvement at a children's ward of celiac patients. Audrey Hepburn spent her childhood in the Netherlands during the famine, and despite her later wealth, she had lifelong negative medical repercussions. Some studies have suggested that epigenetic damage caused by the famine has increased morbidity in the grandchildren of hunger winter survivors. End quote. That's just the beginning. There has been a great deal of research since, and Peter Ward plowed through it all, summarizing and documenting his sources. In April 2010, I recorded a public event in Vancouver with four experts called Epigenetics, Genes Developed Through the Generations, How Experience Modifies Our Genes. You can get a lot out of that, and I will put a link to the audio in my show blog at ecoshock.org.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Now, I have a short speech you need to hear. Craven politicians all over the world deny or ignore the developing tragedy of wrecking the climate. But in October, Canadian Green Party leader Elizabeth May spoke the hard truth to the Canadian Parliament. Here it is.
I want to begin by quoting some words, Mr. Speaker. Quote, humanity is conducting an unintended uncontrolled, globally pervasive experiment whose ultimate consequences could be second only to global nuclear war, close quote. Those words, Mr. Speaker, were the opening sentence of the consensus scientific report from the Toronto Conference in June 1988, when this government, this country, was in the lead on climate change, working with the World Meteorological Organization, the United Nations Environment Program. The warnings from science were clear then. They remain crystal clear now. That was in 1988. I've had a ringside seat, Mr. Speaker, to decades within which we could have arrested climate change before our glaciers were melting, before we were losing the Arctic, before our forests were on fire, before we saw drought and climate refugees and tornadoes in Ottawa. We had a chance in the 1990s, and we blew it. We had a chance in the first decade of this century, and every time there's been a warning from scientists, the alarm bell rings and society hits the snooze button. I'm increasingly drawn to the conclusion that our biggest problem is the short-term mindset that preoccupies political parties, not just in Canada, but around the world. Where's the bravery? Where's the courage? There are all those people surrounding every politician saying, well, you can't win an election telling the public the truth. You can't tell people that they're going to have to stop using an internal combustion engine, leave fossil fuels on the ground. You want to tell them that? Well, that's not going to be politically popular. But if we're grown-ups in this place, if we face the science clear-eyed with a serious intent that says, all right, this is one report where we can't afford to hit the snooze button, because this time the scientists are telling us 1.5 degrees is far more dangerous than we thought it was. Reminds me of what Al Gore once said, that if we let the climate crisis continue apace, it would feel like a nature walk through the Book of Revelation. Well, we've allowed greenhouse gas emissions in the atmosphere to increase to such an extent that we have already changed the chemistry of the atmosphere. We can't change it back. We are leaving that hospitable period within which human civilization took root. We got up and started walking on two legs and then became the dominant force on the planet. And in a geologically and planetary lifespan, in a blink of an eye, humanity is the dominant force on this planet. We are entering the Anthropocene, where what we do has a bigger effect than anything else on life on Earth. And in the Anthropocene, now we are being told, you, Homo sapiens, the clever species, the smart ones, you have at most 10 to 12 years maybe to ensure that you stop greenhouse gas emissions rapidly, you ramp up what we can do with sequestration through protecting every forest and replanting as many as possible, and we're going to have to do some things besides that too. If we want to ensure we hold global average temperature increase to no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above what it was before the Industrial Revolution. And parts of this report could have been much worse. We know from those who were in the IPCC negotiation, and bear in mind, this is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Yes, it's composed of scientists, but they're appointed by government, and this is a negotiated document. And pressure from the United States and Saudi Arabia took out the parts of the report that would have warned us, oh yes, if you miss 1.5, it's bad. That's in the report. If you hit 2, it's much more dangerous. They took out the part about runaway global warming. We don't know when we'll hit a tipping point in which it becomes irreversible self-acceleration, where the ultimate consequences are not brace yourself for bad weather, but brace yourself for millions of species going extinct. And even if humanity can hang on, can we imagine hanging on to human civilization in a 4-degree, 5-degree, 6-degree, 7-degree world? The answer is no. So we have one chance only, within which all the nations on Earth agree that we met what we said in Paris. We must hold global average temperature increase to no more than 1.5 degrees. And in this, the IPCC special report contains good news, because it says you can do it. It says there are no physical, geological, geochemical, there are no conditions of planetary existence, technical or economic, that will prevent us from achieving the goal of protecting our children's future. not future generations in the hypothetical, the children here, now, the grandchildren I tuck into bed at night, those children, not hypothetical children. All of us know those children. They are our children. We have one chance to ensure that in their natural lifespans, they enjoy a hospitable biosphere that has sustained humanity since we first got up and walked on two legs. So the issue is not to debate tonight Canada's current carbon plan, Canada's current climate plan. This is not a status quo debate. And we shouldn't be scoring political points because one party did this and another party did that. We should be here as humanity, human beings, elected people for our constituencies who know full well that if we don't change what we're doing as a species, we will face an unthinkable world. And the good news is we still have a chance to save ourselves. I increasingly, Mr. Speaker, am drawn to thinking about the 5 days in May 1940 when Winston Churchill was surrounded by people, the Lord Halifaxes and Chamberlains, who said, well, face facts. We can't defend this island. The Nazis are invading. Our entire army is now stranded at Dunkirk, 300,000 men, and you can't get them off. There's no way. So face facts and surrender. This is the moment when real political leadership steps up. This is where we need our Prime Minister to go to or to dispatch the Minister of Environment to the negotiations in Poland saying, we're stepping up. We're going to rescue everybody. We're going to be the heroes in our own story. We're going to adopt what the IPCC says we must do and 45% reductions by 2030. Churchill, of course, surrounded by naysayers, thought up a miracle, one that's clearly undoable. How many civilian boats are there in Dover? Oh, we could get those civilians to cross the English Channel and rescue over 300,000 men. Really? It's hardly plausible. But in this time and in this age, we need to face facts just as squarely, and we need to say to Canadians, we've got hope. Do not despair. Do not think it's too late. Don't turn away from the IPCC reports. Don't be afraid because we can't breathe in British Columbia in the summer from forest fires. Don't give up. We rally. We marshal every small town, every big city, every Canadian group, Rotary clubs, church groups, and we tell those naysayers who think that climate change is about a cash grab that they are in the way of our future and they must get out of the way. But we also sadly must say to our own Minister of Environment, it's not true that we can't change our target for 5 years. The Paris Agreement says clearly any country can replace its own target any time. And the IPCC report has said to us as a country that our target is approximately 50% too little. We need to do twice as much. I know that's hard, but to save the lives of our children, what wouldn't we do? Why won't we rally round the call that we go to COP24 and say, we're not going to wait 5 years. It's an unthinkable thing what the minister said to us. She said we're going to wait till 2023. Read between the lines. That's what she just said. We must go to the next climate negotiation as leaders in the world with the target the scientists have told us we must have, and then we must stand up and challenge the others. Where's your target? Where's your goal? Because we are not prepared to tell our children we are a failed species. We are not going to do that because we are responsible human beings. We are Canadian parliamentarians, and we can together achieve the pathway that's been put before us by the world scientists. Time is not on our side. History may not be on our side. But by God, we better be on our own side. We better grab this chance and make it real. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
That was Canadian Green Party leader Elizabeth May speaking to Parliament in October 2018. We could only wish all our politicians could be so brave, or at least that they will hear her and turn towards climate action. Elizabeth led the Canadian Sierra Club for many years before becoming elected. She attended major climate conferences for decades. She has not given up and still says we have a slim chance to save ourselves, and we must. Please tell others about this program and cross-post it to your social media. These voices need to be heard. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock and for caring about our world.